Welcome to Curated Conversations, a podcast discussing real-world issues of equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging. I'm your host, Shaliza Jamal, founder of Curated Leadership, an organization that fosters partnerships with individuals and companies to develop their knowledge in the areas of equity and diversity to build inclusive communities. Today, I'm joined by Ome Salma Rahimtullah for episode 20 of Curated Conversations. Welcome, Ome. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. I'm going to tell our listeners a little bit about you. Ome started at Foodshare South Carolina in February of 2021 to build Foodshare's regional and national coalition participation and provide policy direction for the organization. Ome works on building advocacy and energy around statewide policies such as SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, expansion, and Healthy Bucks, assisting regional hubs to engage with their elected officials at all levels, and entered into this role of interim executive director in August of 2023. Ome has 15 years of community engagement work in food security, community media policy and programming, and an academic background in cultural studies and race. Her doctoral research examined the gender discourses of migration of Asians from Tanzania to Canada during the post-independence era. Ome, lots of wonderful experience you have. Tell us a little bit about how you started working in the area of food security.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that is a story that goes back to 2004. I was an undergrad at the University of Toronto in international development, and there was a course that was being offered in New College. Do you know, if you're from Toronto, that is, New College is a thing. So it's where there is more kind of progressive courses, more experimental work. And so I just happened to come across this course called Food Security. So I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. Let me take it. The professor was an amazing food advocate in Toronto, Wayne Roberts, who passed away recently, unfortunately. But he really spearheaded the Toronto Food Policy Council in the Department of Public Health, or Toronto Public Health, to really think about food policy and how we can integrate it into a healthcare model or to a public health model. So I took that course with him and we just got along really great. I dove right in because for me, it was an issue of equity, it was an issue of access. And that wasn't just about food, but it was about food, you know? And so that's really what attracted me. And Wayne and I built a really great relationship and he invited me to actually join the Toronto Food Policy Council as back then the youth rep. I don't think I would qualify as a youth rep now, but back then as a youth rep, and also as a way to think about the diversity of food within the city of Toronto. It'll come as no surprise that, you know, the policy council at that time was not all white, but there was, you know, majority white presence. And at that time, there was a lot of movement around thinking about the African food basket and what culturally appropriate food access looks like in the city. So that's when he invited me to join and I had such a great time. But, you know, also what attracted me to the course was that I've been participating in Foodshare Toronto's Good Food Box for years and years and years. I used to be a pickup site at UT Scarborough in the residence. So there at UT Scarborough, unlike main campus, our dorms are houses. And so we cook our own food. And so I took it upon myself to be like a pickup site for the Good Food Boxes at Foodshare Toronto, starting in, I think, 2002 or 2003, and then continued throughout my whole time in Toronto to receive a Good Food Box, you know. So I'd always been interested in food and what food justice and food equity looks like, but it's really that course and Wayne Roberts who pushed me towards this kind of career.
So you went to school for international development and migration. So I'm curious as to why you chose to leave those areas of work and focus on community organizing instead.
International development is fraught. And I learned that real quick. So I did do my undergrad in international development. I worked at Oxfam. And it was that experience at Oxfam in West Africa, in Niger, that really kind of showed me the paternalism, the complete enmeshment in like capitalist profit and colonialism that still exists in international development. You know, I could go on and on about that, but it did not seem like a good fit for me. You know, it was very white. And like I said, it was paternalistic, just the idea of, you know, Canadians coming to work in West Africa and teaching them this and that. And I hardly even had an undergrad degree. And, you know, you're sending me, you know, with Oxfam to go work. And it was unsettling. I did do my master's at Ryerson in immigration and settlement studies. I wouldn't say exactly that I've left that, but it did give me a good foundation for the work that I wanted to do. You know, I went on to do my PhD in migration studies, so that was a good foundation there. But also during my master's, what interested me, along with what you said my PhD topic research was on, was about food. Like, I spent a lot of time looking at immigrant farm acquisition policy. So what would it take for immigrants coming to Canada to have access to land to farm? I, you know, worked as a GA with a professor who was looking at the food cultures of women who moved to Canada from outside of Canada. So how, like, you know, if you're from India or from South Africa or Philippines, you know, these are the women that I was interviewing. How does your food culture change? How does the way you eat change? How does the way you cook change? There's a lot in there. There's a lot of food culture and food ways to look at in migration. You know, I'm still pretty, like, the way I got involved with Food Share in South Carolina is that I was working with a Congolese refugee community to access fresh produce. That's the way that I got involved with the work here. The migration, immigration, settlement, and the ways that they interact with food is very much, you know, part of the work that I still do. And, you know, as a community organizer, a big part of that is, for me, radio. I did community radio for 15 years. I do a podcast now. You know, that's just experience from everything, right? I would say, like, as you do it too, it's like, what parts of our lives can we build into conversations?
Yeah, I appreciate you talking about the connectivity of all of your kind of experiences, but also about, you know, that saviorism or white saviorism and white supremacy that was so fraught in that international development work. I'd love if we could talk about that a little bit more later on as well, and how that may be connected to the work you're doing. But so important that you brought that up, because oftentimes, even when it comes to food security, and, you know, when you were volunteering or doing the work, we often think about prioritizing communities from the quote unquote West or with a Western background as these knowledge keepers. And I think that's really key. And as well, that's very interesting, your studies around women and their food migration stories, because I think about sometimes the way in which people, including myself, change recipes based on spice availability or based on ingredient availability. And I think that that's so interesting. And how does that change and shape? And of course, we could go down a rabbit hole talking about how that has health implications as well, the changing of food and food groups. But all of that's so interesting. But, you know, for the listeners who don't know what we're talking about when we talk about food security, could you just define it for us a little bit and tell us what is the work of food security?
So food security, you know, I don't know the technical definition off the top of my head, but to be food secure is that you have access to healthy, culturally appropriate food, and that you have the means to produce and acquire that food. That's, you know, the definition of food sovereignty. So food security is similar in the sense that if your food is insecure, you worry about where your food is going to come from. You know, so that's the definition of food insecurity here in the States. So I know we've talked about examples from Toronto, from Canada, but I actually now live in South Carolina. So the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture definition of food insecurity is to worry or the inability to access nutritious food consistently, like once a week or, you know, or ever, I would say. So that's what it is. So how do we build, you know, points of access to nutritious food, but how do we also make systemic change so that nutritious food is accessible and culturally relevant? I think that's really important as well. So that's what we're looking at, right? I teach a course at the University of South Carolina in food systems, right? And what I always tell my students is, like, food is not just a thing on its own. It is a huge global system. So when we look at food access, we have to look at it from a systemic lens. A lot of my students come from exercise science, and they're really interested in nutrition, and they think it's about education and about choice. And it's absolutely not about that. Like, that's a little part of it. But what it is about is accessibility, but also production. How is our food produced? How does it travel the world? This is a global system, the way that, you know, food circulates. So really, for me, it's looking at it from a systemic lens.
Yeah, and I feel like this is something that we should all be learning in primary school. The question, I think, you know, we did touch on this a little bit, but if you could speak a little bit more about what it means to have culturally relevant food, because I think some of our listeners may not know what that means.
So now I'm situated in the Southern context. So depending on where listeners are, like, I'm assuming they're mostly Canadian, this might or might not resonate, but in the South, and this is a good example. This is the example a lot of Southerners use when thinking about culturally appropriate food and nutrition and all that. Over the last like 10, 15 years, kale has overtaken like kind of the discourse about health, right? Kale is a superfood, you know, it's really nutritious, and it is all those things. But in the South, for, you know, almost for centuries, African Americans have been eating collard greens. It is not something we eat in Toronto or in the North necessarily. Collard greens, mustard greens, turnip greens, those are really important and historically relevant foods and very nutritious, right? So kind of that like discourse of the supremacy of kale over collard greens is a really good example of what it means to be culturally appropriate and culturally accessible. Collard greens are very inexpensive. Right. But to not put that forward as an option when thinking about nutrition, again, like what you said, this kind of white supremacist approach to nutrition, this kind of pandering approach to nutrition or even accessibility is, you know, not culturally appropriate, obviously. Right. So thinking about when you work around food access, what food are you striving to make accessible? Are they culturally relevant? Are they historically relevant? Are you working with communities? Are you yourself part of the communities you're working with and kind of know that history? So that's what I'm thinking about when I think about culturally appropriate food. It's really, let's not take away collard greens because we're so enamored by kale. And I'm sure kale has a culturally relevant history to some communities, but not in the South necessarily. Like, you know, collard greens are a very good source of nutrients.
If we think about that, I think that's so important because the media plays a role in popularizing foods, right? Or telling us what we should eat, what we shouldn't. And that's not always rooted in cultural relevance. I think that's so interesting that you brought that up. So thank you for that. And I wanted to kind of step into now the work you do at FoodShare. Can you tell us a bit about the work of FoodShare and how organizations like FoodShare help to fight food insecurity?
So FoodShare South Carolina was started in 2015. No relationship to FoodShare Toronto. So there is a FoodShare Toronto. And when FoodShare South Carolina was starting in 2015, they did look to Toronto as a model. And then the founder couldn't think of a name, so asked if she could just use that name. And they were fine with it. So the name does come from FoodShare Toronto, but no relationship at all.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I thought maybe this was like a global thing. I said, oh my gosh, is FoodShare Toronto like really global that they have different partners everywhere? So I'm glad you mentioned that.
No. So no relationship, just really a stolen name. Stolen with permission. Like, she just could not think of another name. So she was like, can I just use this name? Toronto and South Carolina are so far, no one's ever going to know. And for the most part, people don't, except for me, that when I moved to South Carolina, I was, you know, I couldn't work at first because I didn't have my green card. So I was looking at places to volunteer. And I was like, so I called them up and I'm like, I'm from Toronto. We have a food share. I volunteered a lot with them. So that's how I got involved. I was initially a volunteer. But back to the story of food share. So starting 2015, out of the healthcare context. So this is the caveat here that America and Canada are so different when it comes to their healthcare systems. Like, the American healthcare system is wildly ineffective. The American welfare system is highly ineffective, I think. Obviously, there's no universal single payer access here, and that's problematic because healthcare is really dependent. Even primary healthcare is super dependent on your income and also your employment, which is like, you know, what we're used to in kind of like the secondary tertiary healthcare market. Like, you know, if you have a job, your employer will pay for your prescription meds, will pay for your massage and your chiropractor, and it's a beautiful life. Here, you rely on your employer to pay your healthcare premiums, not all of them, just a part of them, for your primary healthcare. So that's just going to the doctors. So anyways, that's what inaccessibility of healthcare looks like in the States. And then on top of that, we have like a direct cash welfare system. We being Canada, sorry, has a direct cash welfare system. So if you need assistance from the government, you get cash directly. End of story. There are some programs out there, of course, you know, like dental care and prescription aid. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. But here in the States, everything is segmented. So if you're low income and need help from the government, you get food stamps to buy food. You get a Section 8 voucher to pay for your housing. You get Medicaid to pay for your healthcare. Like everything, like there's these kind of like bureaucratic programs that are built. I personally like cash welfare systems. You know, it empowers people to use the money the way that they need it, as opposed to this kind of prescriptive, paternalistic way of distributing welfare. Sorry, another tangent. The United States is a rough place for a Canadian.
But also, like, you know, food stamps can be kind of demoralizing for some folks when it's kind of like a label to people, right? So if they have the cash, they can go to the grocery store like everybody else and it doesn't single them out. So I think that's just something that came up to me. So totally, yeah.
Like, I mean, I think this food stamp system works well here for what it is and compared to what it was. Actually, before we called, I was reading this book about the history of SNAP. So SNAP is what food stamps are not called. So the way it was before, like now it's more effective. And I mean, it's worth defending SNAP because, you know, the alternative is not going to be a cash-based system. But anyway, so the healthcare system, you know, this is the founder was working at a clinic. I think she was a diabetes educator. And patients were always told by the doctor, okay, just eat more fruits and vegetables. And then they would send them along. And she's the diabetes educator and she'd be talking to them. And they're like, I would love to eat more fruits and vegetables, but I can't afford it. And the founder, Beverly Wilson, just had, you know, she's like, you know what? I do a bulk buying program for my neighborhood, you know, because she likes to do it. It's not people that necessarily need the savings. So she's like, why don't I start this as a project within the context of this clinic? And then it just grew from there. So really, you know, our core flagship program is a produce box. It's called a fresh food box. And we buy in bulk, you know. So we buy in bulk. We have a huge warehouse where we pack these individual family size boxes. It's about 19 pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables, 9 to 11 varieties. So it takes away a bit of like choice. But there is 9 to 11 varieties and we keep it, you know, it's not like you're getting 10 pounds of potatoes like you would get at a food bank. You know, these are very well curated boxes. Yeah, there is always bananas. There's always a leafy green. There's always a tuber. So like sweet potatoes are big here. Sweet potatoes, you know, something like this. And then like a nice split between fruits and vegetables. So it's like, you know, you don't have to go necessarily, and I get the box, you don't have to go out and buy any more produce. You have your produce. We do it every other week, and we do here in Columbia, which is the city I'm in South Carolina, it's the capital, we do 800 to 1,000 boxes every other week, which is a lot. So we have this huge warehouse. The produce comes in from a local distributor. Shout out to Send Brothers, that is a great partner. So we're buying in bulk, but they also give us a discount. And we have a great team of volunteers that pack these boxes. And then families can buy the boxes. If they're on food stamps, it's $5. So if they're on SNAP, it's $5 for this 18-pound box of food. Or in cash, it's $20. There's a program called Healthy Bucks. Like, it's an incentive to buy fruits and vegetables because, I mean, the basis of this is that fruits and vegetables are too expensive, right? So the example I always give is calorie for calorie, overprocessed food is cheaper, right? So think about when you go to the grocery store, and then this applies to Canada as much as it does in the States. And if you have a family of like 4 or 5 and you can get an extra large frozen cheese pizza, how much is that going to run you? $7 here?
7 to 10, depending on the brand. Yeah. Even 5. I saw some for $4.99.
Yeah, for the frozen ones, not those fresh, you know, blah, 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 kind of the frozen ones. $5. What produce can you get for $5? You can get a head of broccoli and like two oranges. So what's the decision you're going to make to buy, right? So this is not, food access is not necessarily about making good, nutritious choices. I think it's about access and not access, like access and like, you know, we talk about food deserts and food apartheid areas where there's not even access to grocery stores, but also just, it's an income issue. Fundamentally, food access is about income. This, you know, it's an income issue. That's a place where we're intervening. We're trying to make it cheaper and more affordable to buy fruits and vegetables. So we buy in bulk, and, you know, bulk buying, cooperative grocery stores, these kinds of systems have a really, really deep root in Southern Black culture, in the Reconstruction era, in the Jim Crow era, like Black folks coming together to pool their resources has a really long history here. And that is the history that we're relying on to like bulk buy fruits and vegetables is what we're doing. But then there's a government up. So there's a government, South Carolina government program called Healthy Bucks. It's really incredible. Across the country, they're called SNAP incentives. So the idea is to incentivize people to buy fruits and vegetables by providing them the means to do so, not incentivizing them by like dancing fruits in a commercial, right? That's it's about income, right? And so SNAP is what food stamps are called. It's the Supplementary Nutrition Assistance Program. And so the idea behind a SNAP incentive across the country is that you as a SNAP user put in a certain amount of dollars to buy fruits and vegetables, the government will give you an additional same amount. They will match that amount towards only fruits and vegetables, right? So in most states, it's a double up buck. So you put in $2 for fruits and vegetables, the government gives you another $2 for fruits and vegetables. So now that you have $4 to buy fruits and vegetables, right? The other end of that is that there's a lot of people pushing to ban certain high calorie foods, ultra processed foods from the SNAP program. I personally think that's paternalistic. I mean, if you want SNAP are banned from buying certain products because they're bad for your health, they should be banned for everyone. SSBs, sugar sweetened beverages, like that's a big push to ban that from SNAP. So that's sodas. But you know what? I enjoy a soda once in a while. I enjoy beer once in a while. And I should have the right to buy it. Me, right? And I will always have the right to buy it because I have this access. But people on SNAP who want a soda, like it's just paternalistic, right? To say what you can and cannot buy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's more about the education behind the food rather than, you know, excluding different foods.
Not even the education. It is about access, right? It's about filling your belly with calories. Sodas make you feel full and they're super cheap, right? So, you know, a lot of carrots will make you feel full too if you can afford it. So, you know, as opposed to restrictions, it's incentive. So it's giving you the means you need to buy fruits and vegetables. So that's why for us, the box is $5 on SNAP. So you as a, here in South Carolina, it's a triple amount. If you use $5 of your SNAP, you get an additional $15 to buy fruits and vegetables. So that's how the box is, $5. And then we seek the reimbursement to pay for the rest. So it's not a charitable food system, right? I don't have anything against the charitable food system, but it's not sustainable. You know, food banks were created as a resource during the Depression to shore up missing food access points because people were out of jobs. Now it's an industry. It is here to stay, right? And it's not moving the needle, like I said, on that systemic issue, right? We're just kind of happy to be giving away free food, and that's fine, but it really does rely on the whims of corporate America. Like, how much food are they going to donate? It's rarely fruits and vegetables. And if it is fruits and vegetables, they are a day from being rotten. So it lacks dignity. It's not consistent. And, you know, eating or having access to nutritious food needs to be a consistent thing. You can't eat a bag of celery once a month on the whim of corporate donations, right? So we buy the food. You know, we're responsible for bulk buying the food. So this is a purchase. You order it ahead of time. You're making a purchase, we're putting in the orders. We have an order deadline. So, you know, we're putting in as many orders as we need of the fruits and vegetables so that there's no waste. And it's, you know, it's grown since 2015 to be this really kind of well-oiled machine. So that's kind of like the flagship program we do. That's the kind of theory behind it. And then we have a bunch of kind of programs that support it. So here in Colombia, people in other parts of the state were like, this program is amazing. Can you teach us how to do it? So we have spread to 20 counties across the state, working with local nonprofit community-based organizations that want to replicate the BOX program. So we do that. And as I said, we're situated within the health context. So we have, you know, a really growing food is medicine department. So really understanding that food is an important part of health. And that here in South Carolina, for example, diet-related diseases are disproportionately affecting low-income communities, Black communities as well. So addressing that from a diet-related standpoint and an access-related standpoint. So we have a produce prescription program where we work with clinics across the state and they can prescribe you as a prescription a box of fruits and vegetables, and then you come and pick it up at your food share site. And you get a free box. You get free boxes for like 6 months, and then you can opt to join in using your SNAP card. And then we do what's called culinary medicine to really build the skills and the knowledge around how to use this box of fruits and vegetables you now have. That might not be something that your family did. So we have community cooking classes, but more importantly, we teach medical students at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine an elective course in nutrition. Med students are not required to take a class on nutrition. And when you think about how many diseases are diet related, especially in the South, especially in the US, the number one is diabetes. Like diabetes is such an issue here, type 2 diabetes, which I don't know, not as big in Canada as it is here. You know, again, systemic issue, you know, people just don't have access to nutritious food, but they have over access to over processed foods. And hypertension is a big issue. So we really teach a course to our future medical students about how they can talk about diet and nutrition with their patients and really give these doctors the skills. And everything that we do in that medical sense is not to replace your medications, but really to complement it, because we do know diet influences type 2 diabetes. That's not, you know, new information. It's highly relevant. But how do you as a doctor have the skills to teach that? So that's, I think, a really important intervention in our culinary medicine program. And then we have an advocacy and policy branch. I mean, obviously, we do evaluations, and then we also do advocacy. I think as an organization that has a statewide reach that works with so many local populations, it is incumbent upon us to use that voice to push systemic issues, like to go to the state house and to advocate for policies that increase access to nutritious food. So that's what I used to do, right? I used to be the director of advocacy and policy, and that was really important for me. Like, we can do all of these programs and they're great, but if we don't push systemic policy change, we should be aiming to have these programs not exist anymore, because the policy arena is such that people can afford or have access in whatever way to fruits and vegetables. So I read this great book. It's called Big Hunger. And the author really does suggest that nonprofits dedicate 10% of their resources to advocacy and coalition work. I really do support that call. And so advocacy is really, and policy issues are really important.
Yeah, I think that's something I'd love to read and learn more about. Now, you mentioned this kind of red tape a little bit and this advocacy and policy. So there are various players in this work, legislators, politicians, developers, farmers, distributors, and even grocery stores. So who do you think is ultimately responsible for the security of food? How do we make food secure?
I don't know if we can name one actor, right? As I said on the top, this is a system. Right. And that's why it's even harder to address, because it is a system. It's these different things working in conjunction on top of each other. I mean, ultimately, the ideal would be like a food sovereign system where we're not responsible, but we have sovereignty over our food access. Like, that would be the ideal. You know, we're not there yet. That is definitely a push in the food access world, is to have sovereign control over where our food comes from. And in that, it really does come from indigenous food ways, indigenous food knowledges about having sovereignty over your food access. Like that would be the ideal. And I think that's what people are working towards, you know, with community gardens and bulk buying programs. Where we are right now is that we're in a global food system, right? Especially in a place like South Carolina. You know, we're in a food apartheid area, right? It's not that this good food doesn't exist. There is enough good food to feed everyone in the world. There's also a lot of really bad food in the world, right? You know, we need to think about how we get our good food, but how we eliminate this bad food as well. So truly it is a global system, and truly it is going to take work from everyone, policymakers, farmers, you know, multinational corporations, food activists. Like it's going to take us all to build a holistic system, because it is a holistic system. You can certainly carve out your space. I could make my garden and never have to like buy food from anywhere. I'm certainly not a gardener, but I'm thinking, you know, more of what it would look like on a holistic level. I just don't think we can, you know, personally, the way I just don't think we can carve ourselves out of this just horrible food system. I think we need to make the changes at every level.
And like you said, it's systemic, so it will take time, but it takes all of us to commit to that. And you mentioned food apartheid. I've also heard the word food desert. And right now, you know, in Canada as well, and I think globally as well as in the U.S., you know, we're feeling the inflation costs majorly at the grocery store. I know I was looking to, you know, I have a newborn, as you know, and so I was looking to use Instacart or, you know, a grocery delivery. I'm busy with the baby, and I usually make this ground turkey dish, and ground turkey is usually $4.99. It was $8.99. And I was flabbergasted because I haven't gone and maybe bought that for a few months, or maybe I didn't look at my bill properly. But I was like, why is it almost double, right? That was crazy to me. Is it the cost of food? Is it people, you know, is it what's happening in the world? I don't know. So it was really, you know, alarming to me. And our dollar doesn't stretch in the same way it used to. You know, our bills are doubling. And I can only imagine for folks who come from lower socioeconomic status, how that might be impacting them. So can you tell us a little bit about this phenomenon that's happening today? Maybe what the words are, you know, you talked about food apartheid, food desert, and how they affect our daily lives.
So I'll touch first on this like inflation and the rising cost of food. Like, I don't want people to listen to this and after I say this be like, ah, she's a wacko activist, cynic. Listen, I am the executive director of a statewide organization. I'm not some like, you know, activist. It is corporate greed. Absolutely. I think we saw the you know, the cost of food rise after, you know, the pandemic. That was a supply chain issue. The war in Ukraine is affecting the cost of wheat because it's a global system, right? I teach this, and we do this unit in the class that I teach at the University of South Carolina, about how the war in Ukraine and the Russian invasion of Ukraine is affecting the price of bread in Egypt. You would never think those things are connected, but they're absolutely connected because this is a global system. So there is those things. There are supply chain issues. But ultimately, after all of those things were settled, corporations are gouging us. Corporations are gouging because there is no regulation, right? That's why policy and advocacy work is so important. That's why policy, it's not to like advocate for good food or good food in schools. Like, obviously, I think that's what it is. But when I say policy and advocacy work, I mean restricting the ability of multinational corporations, the Kellogg's, the Purdue's, all of those companies in the world to stop their profit seeking. Like, they pay subpar wages and keep a lot of profits. That's ultimately what it was. If you have a shock to the system like COVID, you're not ever seeing the prices go down when they should. There's a lot of economic theory, and I'm not an economist, but I do read that stuff. I'm not saying this off the top of my head. There is a lot of arguments for Ukraine and supply chain issues to have caused the significant food inflation we're seeing now. Like, it is, we're seeing it, right? We're 100% seeing it. But there's also an argument, an economic argument to be made for price gouging. I mean, as Canadians, we saw that in Loblaws. Like, there was some sort of accountability. So this is not a fringe idea. And whatever you got, your $5 bread coupon or whatever we ended up getting from it. Like, there's not even any consequences, right? So there is an economic argument to also be made for profit-seeking and for profiteering off of these kind of global events.
It's like they already see, that they like inflated the prices during COVID. People were buying it. So they're saying, oh, well, we're going to keep those prices high, right? People are going to buy it.
Yeah, because they have no choice. It's food. It's not a car. It's not a house. You got to buy your food, right? But I think when we look at our biggest food sellers, which are Amazon and Walmart here in the States, I'm not sure about Canada, during the pandemic, their profits and their CEOs' profits increased. So there is space there to kind of bring the prices back down. If you're interested in that as a listener, I would say go do some reading. There's a lot of economic analysis work on that. In terms of food, apartheid and food deserts. So food deserts was a term that was used to describe an area, a neighborhood. And there's, again, a USDA definition where within 1 mile, there's no grocery store. So that's the technical definition of a food desert. And an amazing Black activist named Karen Washington, was like, okay, that's a good analogy. But deserts, when you think of a desert, you think of a natural forming phenomenon. That is not what's going on. That's why she uses the word food apartheid, which means that these neighborhoods without access to grocery stores, without access to farmers markets or outlets of good, nutritious food, are policy choice, right? It is a form of apartheid. This is not a natural occurring phenomenon, you know, through redlining here in the States, through kind of like for grocery stores to be able to maintain and make a profit in a certain neighborhood, there has to be a certain density, you know, it's, you know, economics. And so the kind of suppressed incomes in certain neighborhoods, that is a policy choice. That is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. That is history. That is Jim Crow, redlining, all of these kind of policy choices that have happened to create neighborhoods that don't have grocery stores. So Karen Washington was like, food apartheid is a better word to be used for this phenomenon. And there's also food swamps. That is a term that's used because the idea is, it's not that there's no food access, it's bad food access. When you come visit me one day, Shaliza, you'll see that unlike in Canada, groceries, or unlike in Toronto, I don't know the rest of Canada, but corner stores here don't sell fruits and vegetables. So we're really used to like kind of the bodega model in New York. If there's Americans out there, I think they're similar. But, you know, our corner kind of Korean convenience stores have a plethora of fresh fruits and vegetables, right? Like even more than grocery stores sometimes. That is not the case here. Corner stores, gas stations in these food apartheid areas are there and they do provide food, right? But they're chips and pop and Little Debbie's cakes and nothing healthy, right? So that's also part of food apartheid is that there are a bunch of these stores that sell food, but they're not healthy choices. So that's the word, you know, food apartheid, food swamp, food desert. That's where it comes from. And that's what it describes.
Thank you. And thanks for sharing a little bit about how, you know, that impacts people's lives, right? They don't have access to nutritious food. So they're either traveling or paying a lot of money, or they're eating poor food, which you already described from a medical standpoint can cause diseases, right? Like diabetes, as you were saying. So that's very important to talk about. You also mentioned redlining and you talked about, you know, communities like Black communities in the States who are really feeling the impacts of this. So can you tell our listeners how food security is an issue of justice and race, and how does it affect our larger communities as well?
So like I said from the beginning, like food insecurity is an economic issue. It's an income issue, I think, right? So like I do this guest lecture for another professor in his class about like food access policies. That's the work I did. And what is the number one policy that will affect food insecurity? It's raising the minimum wage. whenever anyone asks me that, and that's not the answer they want to hear, but that's the answer they're going to get, because that, I think, is the real access. So that's how it is a justice issue. In my work in food security, I'm really passionate about unions. South Carolina is not, the South in general, is not an active union space. And that's obviously historical, and that comes from the legacy of slavery, the kind of suppression of union and union building here. So when you live in a place, and I'm learning, right? I'm not from the South. I'm from Canada, you know, originally from Tanzania, but I'm learning, right? And I'm really learning about the legacies of slavery, which is a legacy of racism, which is a legacy of income inequality. They're co-constituted. You know, we can't separate race from poverty. That doesn't mean all Black people are poor. That's not what I mean, right? But what I mean is slavery or enslavement was built on your race, right? And that is an economic system. Slavery, I always tell my students, the reason South Carolina now is one of the poorest states in the country is because it was one of the richest enslaves and enslaved people, right? The whole economy relied on the system of slavery. And when that taken away, you know, legacies are still there. We see the legacies of what that looks like. That looks like extreme income inequality, extreme segregation. I've never lived in a place that's so segregated.
Thinking about this idea of, you know, race and food insecurity and economics, you can't separate them, right? They're intersectional.
Yeah, yeah. Not only intersectional, they're co-constituted, right? Like our ideas of race are intertwined with our ideas of poverty, right? And poverty is a constructed, as much as race is, like a constructed identity. But especially in the States, there's no way to pull those apart necessarily because of the history of enslavement. You know, so especially in the South, that becomes a part of what food insecurity and food access looks like. And so, you know, there's always this discourse that, you know, revolves around food security and race, that enslaved people had the worst part of the animal. And so that's the way they learned to cook. And so that they're cooked. That's a cultural thing. And that's, and culture obviously is a part of race and segregation and all of that for sure. But you know, when you think about food access, it is about income and about legacies of enslavement. And like, what are the ramifications of that in the world today or in the South today?
Absolutely. And I've heard that from around the world, actually. You know, I haven't delved into deeper, but there were stories about how recipes and foods became popular because of different things happening around the world, or famine or socioeconomic status and all of that, right? And how foods became part of a diet. Just like fast foods today are part of a diet, right? For folks who can't afford a food box or can't afford fruits and vegetables, right? And that becomes part of that family history or cultural history. So very, very important to think about. So one of our last questions I'd love to ask you is that if you could wave a magic wand and have food security for all the members of every community, what would that look like?
In my podcast, I ask this question too. If I had a magic wand, what policy would you implement? That's the, you know, I do a politics podcast. I think it would look like food sovereignty, that we have the means to feed ourselves and to feed our communities. I could talk about, you know, like I said before, like raise a minimum wage. That would, I think, in some ways address food insecurity, but really putting the power back into the hands of communities and having the means, the resource, whatever that is. I'm not saying that looks like everyone having their own garden. That's not what I mean. But communities collectively having the means to provide culturally appropriate foods for community members. So whatever that might look like, it might look like, you know, community-owned B Corp slaughterhouses, or like, I'm not, you know, so it is kind of, for me, it would be the idea or the concept or the theory of food sovereignty, that we, you know, have accessibility and the means to culturally appropriate foods.
Right. Taking back the power.
Yeah.
And lessening that
profit a little
bit. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm thinking about my grocery bill right now, and I'm like, oh, can I order that? Can I not order that? So I'm really interested in everything you're saying, and it's making me also think about alternative places. And maybe it's inconvenient for me, but maybe I should make that effort to go to a local farmer or to a farmer's market, you know, because that's ultimately where I want to buy my food and where I want my money to go. So really thinking about that.
And capitalism is inconvenient. Like, it, you know, part of it, it's built on capitalism, but part of it is like convenience, right?
Absolutely.
I can order online. I can go to a drive-through, like
Instacart, Amazon Prime, one day delivery, same day delivery. Yeah.
But we live in that. And I'm, like I said, there's no way to kind of carve out something outside of that. Like, it's hard to carve a world outside of that. Just go to the apartment. We have, I mean, unfortunately, we're working moms. We're like, you know, have families and, you know, are really super busy. And like, what are the things that you can do? But it's, again, it's a systemic issue. It's not an individual. And that's what capitalism also wants us to think, that these are individual choices, right? Like that's a neoliberal agenda, to kind of like individualize choices and break down that kind of collective power. So it's not about you building your garden. It's not something you can do on your own. It's really, how do we collectively, like you said, take back the power, take back kind of the dignity of our food.
It's like both end, right? So thinking about that and coming together as community, right? And perhaps, like, you know, thinking about what that looks like, and maybe that is volunteering at Food Share South Carolina, or volunteering at Food Share Toronto, or coming together with people on your block to say, like, let's start something. A little bit difficult in the winter here, but thinking about those community gardens. I know there's a lot of them around the city that I've seen. So great, great ideas. So I'd love to end this podcast. You know, you've talked about so many important topics. I could talk to you for hours. I'm so intrigued by so many things that you've said. But I'd love to ask you, our last question is, what brings you joy, Ome? It could be this work or anything outside of this work, anything related, but what brings you joy?
There's two things lately that I would just love to dive into. One is to cook. I'm trying to like actually do the cooking. You know, like, I think before we used to rush through it. Like, I like to just sit there and chop, you know, chop. I'm just thinking about the cabbage I have in the fridge that I got to chop. So that brings me a lot of joy. Cooking, you know, just the joy of creating something out of separate ingredients. Like, I'm not going to eat a head of cabbage on its own, but when I make spring rolls out of it or a salad out of it, it's just like that transformation. It's almost artistic. The other thing is, I just love to go in my bed and read, just take myself into another world, into a story. Like, I love a good plot. Those are the things, simple things, very simple things that bring me joy.
I love that. And I just love the message in that about slowing down and thinking about that food and the ingredients and how it makes a meal, right? So I love that. It's making me hungry, actually. So as we come to the end of our podcast today, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners?
I think we're good. We covered a lot. And so just thank you for inviting me. You know, really encourage, if you're in Toronto, to get involved with the work of Food Share Toronto. They're an amazing organization. If you ever find yourself in South Carolina, hit us up.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, where can folks learn about you, your work, and about Food Share South Carolina? We'll put it all in the show notes if you just tell us.
I don't know. I thought about a website. I was like, I'm going to post more on Instagram and Twitter. I never do that. So there's, I don't know, just Google me, I guess. Ome Selma Rahimtula. But definitely Food Share South Carolina. We're all the socials, foodsharesc.org.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Ome. I've really enjoyed, you know, chatting with you and learning a lot more than I thought I would about food insecurity and how we can be food secure. So really encouraging folks to listen, get involved, and remembering that we got to bring people along with us to make this community work and to advocate. And maybe we can look up some ways that folks can advocate here in Canada and how we can drive some policy change. And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in to this episode of Curated Conversations. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share this podcast. Subscribe at our website, curatedleadership.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also stay connected with us on Instagram at Curated Leadership. And don't forget to download our free EDI glossary and subscribe to our newsletter for even more resources on leadership, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Curated Conversations.